Hello, and welcome to The Canadian Story, where we discuss what Canada is, what Canada could be, and what Canada should be.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for being here, and welcome to The Canadian Story. Today, we are joined by Paige McPherson. Paige, welcome to the show. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
We're looking forward to it, too. So Paige, why don't you brief your background and tell us who you are and what you are all about?
Sure. So I work for the Fraser Institute as the Associate Director of Education Policy there, where we do a lot of research into K-12 education primarily in Canada, looking at every province, just the different policies that shape the education systems in each province, the spending, all sorts of stuff under that umbrella. So that's my role. I have a background in public policy, a master's of public policy, and in communications and journalism as well. And I think today we're going to talk about educational choice, school choice for parents and kids. And that does sort of color a lot of the work that we do at the Fraser Institute.
Okay, so school choice, that's a great place to start. I feel like school choice is one of those phrases that gets kind of lightly thrown around and people kind of have a concept of what that might mean, but it's never really a drilled down in focus picture. So what exactly is school choice?
You're right. So it really is kind of a broad umbrella term for a whole bunch of different policies that impact kids and where they're educated. In essence, it's really just allowing parents, children, families to decide what school they attend. That is really the basic definition and meaning of school choice. But what it can mean is really making that possible. Because in theory, every family could choose whatever school they want to in Canada. You know, you could choose to go to an independent or private school. You could choose to stay home and homeschool or join a homeschool collective. In one province, Alberta, you could choose to go to a charter school, or of course you could go to your local government public school. But it's really not as easy as that, because a lot of these things come with tremendous financial sacrifice on the part of many families. If you are wealthy, then sure, you probably do have school choice. You have the ability to attend any school that you want, be it an independent school, be it a boarding school in another province or country. You have the means to make that happen. But for most families, the government might have to create policies that actually make it easier for families to really make that choice to be able to choose their own school. So whether that is sending a portion of that family's tax dollars to an independent school, if that's the school that they choose, which then makes the tuition more affordable for that family to send their child to that school, that's an option. Whether it's allowing charter schools like in Alberta, whether it's giving families some tax relief, or even the ability to homeschool with some kind of government subsidy for educational materials, so one parent can stay home and can purchase those things, just making it easier for families to make those choices. And there's also choice, you know, within government public schools in that system. You know, there's catchment areas in some provinces that do bind kids to that area. So you're really stuck going to your local government public school, even if you found that that is not the best fit for your child or your family for educational reasons, for bullying, whatever the reason might be. Catchment areas tend to kind of constrict families and kids to attend the school in that area. So governments can even free that up, allow sort of open enrollment, allow kids to choose whatever kind of government public school in any area, doesn't matter their postal code that they go to. So really, oh, there's also, I guess I'll just mention as well, there's choice programs sort of within government public schools. The Edmonton public school model is a great example of this. There's all sorts of different types of schools within that. So you might go to a performing arts high school or a gifted high school or a sports high school or a high school that has a focus on kids with more diverse exceptional learning needs. Some of those do exist within the public system, though they're more limited, but they do exist within Canada. So even those are forms of educational choice. So like I said, it's a big umbrella term that covers a lot, but in essence, just allowing families to make the choice and making it possible for families to make that choice to send their child to the school that is the best educational fit for them.
Yeah, okay. That makes sense. Is it already policy in Canada that in some scenarios you can take government subsidy for the purpose of sending your child to a different, say, private school as opposed to the public education system? Is that already in place? Because that would be a fantastic policy.
So we don't have what it sounds like you're describing is more of a voucher system, which is not exactly what we have in parts of Canada. So what that would look like is literally giving parents, giving every family a portion of money, a portion of their tax dollars to then take to whatever type of school they want and use that voucher to pay for that school. And that really, that is it's a great school choice policy that they do have that. For example, something that I was just doing some research on was in Denmark, in the upper secondary school system, they do have that kind of a voucher system where it really is, it's quite empowering for families to be able to make those choices. So we don't have exactly that in Canada, but in 50% of the provinces, we do have what I would call sort of independent school choice. So we do in, Quebec has, quite a great deal of choice for families relative to other provinces, Manitoba, Saskatchewan, Alberta, BC. You have basically a portion of families' tax dollars gets sent to the school of their choice. So the money follows the student, but it never goes directly into the hands of parents. So basically it goes from the government to the independent school based on enrollment. So schools are funded based on enrollment, and that's how the money follows the student. And in turn, independent schools can then lower their tuition so that it is more affordable and more accessible for families to attend. And so, like I said, you have that in 5 out of 10 provinces. But if you're in Ontario, where of course we know the cost of everything is very high, that does not exist, even though there are quite a large number of independent schools in Ontario. You don't have that policy in place empowering families with their tax dollars. So it does make it a lot more out of reach for a lot of families. And then in Atlantic Canada, where I live, really across the whole region, we don't have that in place other than one very small program in Nova Scotia called the Tuition Support Program, which is really just for kids with very exceptional learning challenges.
Yeah. Okay. Still though, I guess the small differential there is that it doesn't, the tax dollars aren't refunded to the family. They're sent directly to the school, but that's still in my mind. It's just an absolutely bang on policy. I think that's really, really great and empowering for families to be able to have a little bit more control as to where their child goes to school. I have a friend who, I guess we're in Ontario, so I guess she's not in that situation, but I have a friend who sent her kids to private school, a Christian private school, even though they're not a religious family, and they are just having the best experience there because it's just a little bit smaller and it's a little bit more fine-tuned for them, and they're really enjoying that. So why is it that those options are available in some provinces and not other provinces? You mentioned everything in Ontario is expensive. I don't yet understand how that would apply to this particular policy of subsidizing the student at the school if they want to go to a different school than the public school that's available to them.
Sure. So the reason I brought up the cost of living in Ontario, so I'm from Ontario. There really is very little school choice in Ontario outside of the government system. So, you know, in Ontario, there's Catholic schools that are kind of within the public school system, and then there's public schools, but they're all government schools. And then there's French and English, French immersion. So you've got, through that, different streams of choice within the government public system that many other provinces don't have. But what you don't have in Ontario is the educational choice to be able to send your child to an independent school, having some of the tax dollars that you pay go to that independent school, and therefore funding the education that you want for your child. So the reason that I brought up the cost of living is because in Ontario, the taxes are quite high relative to many other provinces in Canada.
The cost of housing.
Yeah, I know. Same here in Nova Scotia. The taxes are very high. And in Ontario, the cost of housing is very high. It's prohibitively high for many families to even enter the housing market at this point. The reason that matters is because then if you're a family and you're looking at your budget and you're thinking, okay, the public school that we're currently sending our child to, the government public school, is really not a great fit for whatever reason. Kids are not one size fits all. The government public system is very one size fits all. So it doesn't really matter, you know, where your child fits on any sort of educational spectrum. It just may be that they're not being challenged enough, or that it's too challenging, that the classes don't allow for that kind of tailored education that they need. As you mentioned, you know, your friends who attend a Christian independent school, they're not religious, but there are many families that are and want that kind of cultural education for their child, whether it's a Sikh school or a Jewish school or a Christian school, whatever the reason might be. But if you're a family in Ontario looking at your budget and you're thinking, okay, what can I afford? Because the cost of living is so high due to taxes, the housing market, whatever it might be, it makes it more difficult to then say, we're going to have this extra money set aside to pay the tuition at an independent school to take my child to that school. Or if you want to homeschool, it makes it a lot more difficult to say, okay, I'm going to stay home part-time or full-time with my children and homeschool them, because that financial choice is really just not available to families who are feeling really squeezed by the cost of living. And so that's why it matters. And, you know, just to kind of get back to what you were saying before about the policy being empowering for families, really, regardless of whether it's a voucher system that they get or whether the money follows the child to the school, I would agree with you. I mean, these are all just different types of school choice policies that could be put in place. But regardless of really what they look like, they do empower families to be able to make those choices, because they do follow the child to that school. The school is then sort of rewarded with that money. The school has the incentive, whether it's a government public school or whether it's an independent school, they have the incentive to attract more students, to offer more interesting, innovative programming to cater to the market of students that might want to attend there. And so it has those same kinds of motivating impacts, empowering families, motivating the schools with competition, regardless of what the policy looks like. So it is still certainly a form of educational choice, and certainly better than the alternative of having none, like in Ontario.
Yeah. That's another great way to think about it too. In a kind of roundabout way, by awarding those tax dollars to the schools that attract the students, you are kind of putting education, in a sense, on the free market, and the schools that do a better job of crafting programs for the students that attend them do a better job, or get more money from the government because they're doing a better job, which I think you're right. It creates a healthy competition. And that's, I mean, if we're talking about, if the goal of the education is to empower and give the student as much, as good of an experience and as much education as possible, incentivizing schools to perform in that way is a really, really, really smart thing to do as well. Mm-hmm. How does our education system, it's another funny thing. We kind of get locked up in Canada because I don't know your history, but I certainly have spent my whole life in Canada, and you don't really think about how other people might be doing things in different places. How does Canada's education program stack up to other countries in terms of how well it performs?
Sure. So there's different ways of looking at that. So, I mean, there are, in terms of school choice, in terms of educational choice, Canada does not really offer that high of a degree of educational choice relative to many other countries in the developed world, because well, it's province by province. So it's the same in the United States, where they do have quite a bit more educational choice policies in the United States. We're starting to see states introduce education savings accounts, for example. I just saw that in Arizona, where that is, you know, the families are given money to keep in a savings account, and they can choose how they spend those education dollars. So be it on some kind of educational enriching activity like tutoring or something like that, or the tuition at an independent school, whatever that might be. That's another policy that we do see in other places increasingly in the United States. The United States also has a lot more charter schools.
Let me pause you there. I don't know what a charter school is. Can you describe that?
For sure. Absolutely. So charter schools, we have in Alberta, there's only one province in Canada that has them. Essentially, they are, in Canada's case, in Alberta's case, nonprofit, but autonomous schools that are fully funded by the government for parents, meaning parents don't pay any tuition, but they are independently operated. So they function autonomously outside of the government public school boards. They are typically started by groups of parents and teachers in a community to respond to a need in that community or offer some kind of unique form of educational programming. So in Alberta, some examples are there's a music education school, there's an arts school, there are enriched education schools, so sort of gifted programming for kids. There's a school to help kids that have gone through mental health struggles. There's also a school to help kids that have that are English second language or third language, so help extra help with that language component. There's now a STEM charter school. There's now a classical education charter school. There's a rural stewardship charter school. There's an Indigenous charter school with a focus on Indigenous culture. There's a lot of different types of charter schools that exist in Alberta, and really there's not even that many. I don't know the total number right now offhand of charter schools in Alberta, but even just that small sample that I gave you, you can see what kind of a diverse range of programming is offered by charter schools in Alberta. And the reason is because each one needs to have their own unique reason for being, reason for existing. They need to have that autonomous charter, that unique type of programming that they offer that is not offered by the local government public school in their area. So they need to demonstrate that to the Ministry of Education, that their programming that they want to offer is not offered by the local government public school. Then they are approved by the government to open, and they can offer that kind of unique programming. So they need to hire certified teachers. They need to follow the Alberta curriculum, but they have a lot more flexibility and autonomy in the way that they function. Their teachers do not need to be full members of the Alberta Teachers Association, so the teachers union there, which gives a little more flexibility that way as well. And so, yeah, they're really an interesting option to have in the market, not quite as autonomous as independent schools or private schools are, not quite as much freedom and flexibility to offer their programming and tailor it in the way that independent schools have, but they're kind of a middle ground where they do face more regulations, but they are still autonomous and they offer this kind of unique programming. And the demand for these schools in Alberta is quite high. Many of them have very long wait lists. I've heard stories of families signing up their kids, you know, right when they're born to kind of get on a list at some of the charter schools that they want them to attend. And the government in Alberta did have a cap on the number of charter schools for quite some time. So Jason Kenney lifted that cap when he was premier there. And now you do see more charter schools opening up. And so this is a model that is not unique to Alberta. I've just sort of explained in a bit of detail what they look like in Alberta. They can look different in other places. For example, so in Alberta, they're nonprofit. In Sweden, where they have a lot of charter schools, they're for-profit charter schools, but they can't charge tuition. Same within Alberta. And in the States, you've got sort of state by state different types of charter schools that exist there. And in the States, they've done, I think, a better job of tailoring the charter school experience more to lower income struggling kids. Who have, you know, the research shows they've really greatly benefited from charter schools lifting their achievement and their graduation rates. And a number of other sort of social indicators have been lifted by the use of charter schools and the introduction of charter schools into some communities that are lower income in the United States. So that's a really, I think, a powerful way that charter schools have been a success story there. And certainly could be in Canada, but we only have them in Alberta. We do not have them in other provinces. And it's a good question as to why. You know, I know that you, I'm sure, are familiar with the fact that education policy can become quite political as a policy issue. You've got labor unions involved, governments, parents, there's so many stakeholders. And as such, you really have only seen charter schools in Alberta, which were introduced in the 90s. But in my experience, and I have done quite a bit of research in this area, they have been a real success story in that province. So it is an interesting policy, I think, for other provinces to look toward, which again, no tuition for parents. So when you've got a province like Ontario, where the cost of living is high, and that's one of the impediments to sending kids to independent schools, charter schools really could offer an interesting option for parents there.
Yeah. And it sounds at least my first impression is that those schools have the opportunity to be a little bit more catered to the community, in the sense that the public education is going to be a one-size-fits-all thing. It's going to be province-wide. This is the curriculum. This is how it behaves. This is what we do. Whereas that might not be as relevant to a small rural community out in the boonies of Alberta, which makes a lot of sense. It's interesting. So they're nonprofit. They're government-funded, but they are not under the same amount of governmental influence. And I'm always team, for me, this is my own opinion, but I'm always team less government. I love empowering families in the at least in the context of education, empowering families to raise their children with as much grasp on how that goes as possible. So what is the government's incentive for funding these schools, but kind of taking their hands off of it a little bit? How does it benefit them?
Well, something from the research that I've done, and this was a few years ago, but I'm sure that it looks similar today in charter schools in Alberta, is that they really lift students' achievement. So if as a government, you're interested in having a successful student population that's going to go through their K-12 education and find success and then go on to whatever they're going to do next, post-secondary education, trades, starting a business, whatever it might be, that's a benefit for your province, right? If they are going to go on and be successful and then create jobs and inspire others to do the same and find that success and drive change and, you know, make new discoveries, all the different amazing things that children can do when they're empowered with an education that really does help them thrive and succeed and fits them to the extent that they can find that success. So Alberta charter schools are really good at producing strong student achievement. Even though, as I've described to you, it's not as though, oh, they're all gifted schools or something like that. That's not the case. A lot of the schools actually cater to students that have quite exceptional learning challenges or barriers that they're facing. And yet they produce really, really, really strong student achievement relative to government public schools, certainly, but also relative even to independent schools when I did this research. Now, a certain percentage of independent schools in Alberta are special needs independent schools, which, you know, obviously would change the achievement averages at those, you know, on the whole of independent schools. But the charter schools, as I mentioned, they're not all gifted schools either. So when you look at that, I think that is a huge benefit. But it's also that, you know, if you're talking about government incentives, governments are driven by winning elections oftentimes, and parents are very happy with these charter schools in Alberta, you can see that the wait lists are very long. So the demand for these charter schools is high. So the parents are obviously happy if they keep signing up their kids and there is this high demand. So the government allowing this kind of educational option that parents are going to love, I think there is sort of a built-in incentive politically for governments there too. And obviously just if you care about, you know, the population which you serve and their satisfaction and the kids' student achievement, if you care about those things, then, you know, those should be incentives for you as well. But there's also a financial incentive. Charter schools cost the government less money. They cost taxpayers less money. They're fully funded for operations, but they're not funded for capital expenses. So this is actually one of the biggest challenges facing charter schools in Alberta today is it's finding space, physical space. They don't have a lot of money. They can't do the same level of fundraising that some of these independent schools can do. Not all independent schools are well-funded. Absolutely. That's very far from the truth. But some of them can do that kind of fundraising for their capital. Not so for charter schools. Who have to sort of find it. They often will be leasing space in old school buildings or government buildings. But because of that, you don't have that capital cost for charter schools in Alberta. And as such, the per student costs of a charter school are quite significantly lower than the per student cost for sending a child to a government public school. So for each student that attends a charter school in Alberta, it represents a significant savings for the Alberta government. And when you look at that from a bang for your buck perspective, compared to the student achievement that they're getting, there is quite a lot of benefit as a whole, as the province, in having these charter schools, which were kind of started in the 90s as it's kind of like, it was a sort of an experimental policy. We'll introduce this, we'll see how it goes. And it has really been quite a success story in Alberta, and it's created these sort of innovative approaches. As you say, having a school out in the boonies. Like, I love that there's a rural stewardship school in Alberta that's so unique.
And I love that idea.
I'm sure that, yeah, like, I'm sure there's some of your listeners that maybe live in rural parts of Canada that are thinking, wow, that would be so interesting to just like really get connected to the roots of the community, which is rooted in this rural life, and actually make that a part of the educational experience and teach kids about that. Maybe then that would encourage more kids to stay in those areas, create businesses in those areas, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
And you know, that there's another, I mean, that Indigenous charter school that's in rural Alberta too, getting those communities directly involved in the education of the kids, to sort of mirror and be a part of their community. Like, they're just, it's just so much more connected really to the parents, to the teachers who have decided to come together and put the effort in to start this school with this innovative idea. It's a really cool thing. And I mean, if you just think of it from a very basic perspective, you know, what sector has more innovation and interesting new ideas that they're bringing to the table? Would you say it's government bureaucracy, or would you say it's the startup sector?
Yeah.
It's obvious, right? When you've got, you're not sort of hampered by quite as many regulations, the slow moving turns or the wheels and cranks of government, you can be a little more creative and you can be a little more flexible and you can actually create really great and beautiful things with that creativity and flexibility. And so that can be a really interesting thing for kids. And then families can say, you know what, that would be a really great fit for my child. Pair them with that school. And, you know, you can create really magical things when it comes to student achievement.
Yeah. The analytics of that are fascinating to me. So your achievement level goes up and your cost per student goes down. That, excuse me, that is a fantastic thing, because that creates more equipped students for the future of our country who will graduate and go on to be the people who run this country eventually. And it also, it reduces government spending, which I think we could handle right now. So why do you think, obviously, so if we take Alberta as kind of the test pilot, it's, you know, the 90s were 30 years ago now, right? Early 90s. So what, that's we have a 30-year test on it. And thus far, we're getting greater achievement at a lower cost. Why do you think this has not been adopted like wildfire throughout the rest of the country?
Yeah, it's a good question. Like I said, I think that it's the policy process, unfortunately, is very political. And it's the same with independent schools. It's not just charter schools that have these analytics, as you say, right? You've got lower cost per student for taxpayers for independent schools and higher student achievement. So it's the same thing. Both of these models offer this to the government, to taxpayers. There is a cost savings there and a rise in student achievement there. But neither of those models have to hire unionized teachers. So independent schools do not need to hire teachers that are part of the teachers' union in any province. And in Alberta, members or teachers rather at charter schools, which do need to be certified teachers, have to be they can be associate members of the teachers union there, but they don't have to be full members. So if you are a union and your job is to get more members paying more dues, or at least that's part of your job, then you're not going to be in favor of policies that may reduce the number of teachers that are going to be part of your union that are going to be paying your dues. Mm-hmm. So I think that there is that embedded kind of political incentive for unions to push against this. Unions are a powerful force in Canadian politics and in the policy process. And so I think that has been an impediment. You can see it from the advocacy that the teachers unions do in Canada. They advocate against charter schools. Even in Ontario, there are teachers unions, and there's multiple teachers unions, as you know, in Ontario, that have advocated against charter schools. Charter schools have never been in Alberta, or in Ontario, rather. They've never been introduced in Ontario, or even very seriously talked about. And yet the teachers union sort of proactively writes against charter schools in Ontario. So it is something that you kind of see preemptive opposition to. You can kind of understand the sort of built-in financial incentives there. And I think that's one of the impediments. And it's, you know, I think governments move slowly. It's hard to get policy change, but you do have 5 out of 10 provinces that do have that funding for independent schools, that model's already in place. They can look at their own data and see that it's probably saving them money. And the reason that it would save them money, so I'll give you the independent school example, where almost always families have to pay some level of tuition. So yes, a lot of the independent schools have scholarships, bursaries, they have programs in place to help some students attend the schools for totally free in some cases. But they typically charge some level of tuition to families. Now, you might say, okay, well, that's really prohibitive. That cuts all families out other than the ultra wealthy. Well, not really, because if you have families that are kind of on the cusp, a middle-class family that says, okay, my kid is really struggling in their government public school, I really want to find them a different educational fit that's going to be more tailored to them and that's going to work better for them. I have this much money. Let's say it's whatever, $5,000 or something like that. I cannot spend any more than that every year on a school for my kid. If the government is coming in and saying, okay, well, we're going to pay up to whatever it might be, 75% of the cost of a per student cost of a government public school, which is around ballpark $13,000 a year. And so that per student cost of a government public school, we're going to send that to the independent school if that's where you're going to send your child. Family says, okay, well, I have a few thousand dollars here. I can kind of supplement the and then pay the tuition at the independent school. You might have quite a few families that are willing to make that financial sacrifice, say, I'm not going to enroll my kid in dance and hockey. I'm not going to go on vacation. We're not going to get a new car, whatever it might be. We're not going to do that. Instead, we're going to make this financial sacrifice for our family and send our child to an independent school. And so those policies can be very empowering for those families as well, from the government. The government, of course, also, and something that we have written about at the Fraser Institute, can make this a reality for families who straight up cannot afford it at all. You can certainly tailor your policies to make it such that lower income families get the subsidies to attend independent schools, if those are the families who you think cannot access it, or you can do it in a sort of scaled way where if you're lower income, you get more money. Whatever. There's so many different ways that you can do it to really help empower families that may even need it the most. But the point of me saying this is that it actually represents a cost savings where you think, okay, a lot of the teachers union rhetoric is around, well, we're just sending tax dollars to private schools. Well, what you're actually doing is you're putting tax dollars more so in the hands of families that actually pay those tax dollars, and you're allowing them to choose how they use those tax dollars. And it's not wealthy families that are going to benefit from these policies. Those are the families that can already afford it, that are already sending their kids to independent schools if that's their choice. It's the families that maybe just are, it's just too difficult for them, or maybe it's quite a lot difficult for them. I think a lot of the families that are benefiting from the policies that exist within Canada, where you've got sort of a portion of the tuition that tends to be paid, it's a portion of the per student cost of public schools sent to independent schools. You're helping a lot of those families that it does represent a financial sacrifice for them, perhaps a tremendous financial sacrifice for them, but they can sort of contribute a little bit on their own to make that a reality. And at the end of the day, that does represent a cost savings for government, because if you're only paying Again, this is sort of just a ballpark based on what provinces fund, might be more or less, typically less. But if it's 75% of the cost of an independent or of public school tuition or the public school per student cost, well, then you're saving that 25% for every student that attends an independent school. And same for charter schools, right? You're saving that portion for every student that attends a charter school. So if you're looking on a macro scale at all the different students that are going to independent schools, that are going to charter schools, but wouldn't have been able to do it without the government policy in place, making it so that some of their tax dollars are following them to that option, that does represent a cost savings for government. And it could also allow governments to do things in government public schools that they might not otherwise be able to do, reduce class sizes or whatever the policy might be.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that until you just mentioned it, because that is a problem that you hear kicked around, that the public schools are just so overcrowded. You have large classes and it's too much for one teacher to handle, which is, that's not a slight on the teachers in any regard. Keeping 30 students under wraps, especially when they're little, is just insane. Like, I don't know how you even go about doing that. I have a lot of respect for the people who do go about doing that. But yeah, it seems like such a great idea. It takes some of the pressure off the government in terms of spending. It reduces the size of the public classes and it gives the parents more choice about where their kids go. I mean, I love the idea of that policy. Next thing I kind of want to ask you about. So in Canada, the schools are kind of, they're controlled by the provinces, right? It's provincial. Who is responsible for creating curriculum and how do they go about deciding what curriculum is the correct curriculum?
Mm-hmm. That's a provincial government jurisdiction as well. They'll have people that are, you know, they might bring in different stakeholders that'll be involved, sort of different researchers or curriculum experts that'll be involved in those processes in a province if they're going to change the curriculum or tweak it. But it is a provincial government jurisdiction. And of course, the provinces are communicating with one another, talking about different curriculum standards, but the curricula do vary from province to province. So that really is a government process.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Next thing I wanted to bug you about, and I'll speak from my own experience. To me, the way the system is set up, in the sense that, through my childhood, as probably most of our listeners know, I was homeschooled all the way until high school, which for me was a fantastic situation. I loved it. And then I went to high school, a public school. And that was also fantastic for me because I really got to break out and I made a whole bunch of friends, a number of which I'm still very good friends with. But what I observed in my own life, and I think I'm not going to be able to cite anything specific, but I know that this is backed by studies. It, the very least in the case of the male brain, it doesn't really fully develop until like early to mid 20s. So we're talking like 23 to 25. And so what I've observed in myself throughout homeschool, I was indifferent about education. In high school, I performed well enough, but doing the work really, really bugged me. I didn't want that badly to learn. And then fast forward to now, you know, more than 10 years since my graduation from high school, I'm obsessed with learning. My whole take on it is entirely different. And one of my gripes about how the system is set up, and I don't have an answer for this, so this is an entirely open question, is that, you know, at about 16 years old, people started asking me, well, what do you want to do with the rest of your life? What do you want to go to post-secondary for? What do you want to become? And perhaps women are different. I can't speak for women because I'm not a woman, but at least I think for young men, that's a tough question to answer, especially like to put that much weight on a decision at 16 when their brain isn't even close, in my opinion, this is an uneducated opinion, but close to fully being developed. That's a tough question to have to answer at that age. And I certainly didn't feel equipped to answer it. And I floundered a lot in kind of that latter half of my high school education with that question is, what am I going to do next? So what are your thoughts on that? And is there a way that we could possibly remedy that?
Well, I think, I mean, in terms of the pressure that's put on young people to kind of decide what they want to do at a very young age, I think that probably is a very individualized thing. It probably really depends on the kid. But I do think that there are, that all kids are different and all kids learn differently. And so, you know, my research area is K-12 education, but I can tell you that in the different models that exist within independent schools, and within, you know, even in government public school, and how this has kind of an influence on curriculum and in charter schools, many of the models are very focused on the proper things to introduce at proper stages of a child's development. So, for example, take Waldorf schools, which are, I would say, one of the more common models, certainly in Europe, sometimes called Rudolf Steiner schools in Europe. But we see them in Canada as well. There's a Waldorf school in Toronto. There's one in Calgary. There's one in, here in Nova Scotia in the South Shore. And they are very, very focused on the proper things to introduce to a child at the proper developmental stages. So a lot less what you'd probably call academic instruction at a very young age, and a lot more nature-based learning, artistic-based learning. They start to do music before, I'm not a Waldorf expert, so I don't want to speak out of turn here, but music before math as kind of the building blocks of the math education, but without getting right into numbers right away. And just different things, very, very concerned with the developmental stage and what is developmentally appropriate for a child at specific ages and stages, and kind of positing that the current government school curriculum does not necessarily jive with that. So from a young age, and again, it really depends on the kid. I have a 5-year-old son, and I have also 2 nephews that are also 5, 2 other boys. And they're all so different. And so for one of them, you know, very difficult for him to sit in a gymnasium and listen to an assembly or stand in line at school. Those are things that, you know, would be challenging. For another one of my nephews, that would really be not a challenge whatsoever. And for my son, you know, kind of somewhere in the middle of that. But so some of these things, you know, that are kind of just ingrained in this sort of type of education that you're getting at a government public school versus a Waldorf school, for example, where they might be spending a lot more time outside exploring nature, you know, climbing trees and stuff like that, as opposed to sitting in a gymnasium listening to an assembly at age 5, might be kind of a better developmental fit for many kids. And I think ultimately it's up to parents to be able to kind of make those decisions. Where is my child at? What kind of an experience are they going to benefit from? And I mean, what you asked about is a much older age, but this is all kind of building blocks that feed into, okay, introducing things at an age which is appropriate. So if you were attending an independent school, depending on the type of school, they might not be asking you those questions when you're 16 years old, putting that pressure on you. It might be a completely different approach. They might be saying, you know, go and work for a few years before you decide what you want to do, before you pursue post-secondary education, if that's what you want to do. It really depends. And so basically, and some kids might, you know, be saying, I have another niece who, or another, just to bring up my family, now that I'm thinking about them, you know, from the time she was very little, she wanted to be a teacher. She's now almost in junior high, still wants to be a teacher, like probably will be a teacher, right? Some mm-hmm. kids just kind of know. And so it really depends on the kid. I think that kind of putting kids in the schools that are a really good fit for them can help them also just find themselves, right? And can help them come to things when they are developmentally ready, especially at schools which have that more student-centered education, where they do follow the student, which might be a better fit for some kids, with a very specific focus on not introducing things to children not introducing any sort of pressures on children until they are developmentally ready for that, tailored to each unique kid. I think that there's a lot of benefit in that can come from those different school models and the building blocks leading up to high school and then leading up to post-secondary education, which might help kids in the long run. So again, I mean, I'm not maybe specifically answering your question. My area is really more that K-12 space. But I do think that just, you know, those individual tailor fits focused on developmental stages is just such an important part of education. And it might help with the problem that you're talking about.
Yeah, I think that's another.
Obviously you found yourself, right? You found a good place for yourself doing this.
Yeah, I sure did. I made it. I'm doing just fine. and you're right. You're entirely right. Every children is going to be individualized. And just because I struggled with that question at 16 to 18 doesn't mean another young boy would also struggle with that question. I'm sure there were plenty of young men who came to that question at that age and made a decision that they felt was right for them and was right for them. So that's a great perspective. But what that does is it just puts, in my opinion, another point toward this idea of incentivizing privatized education or incentivizing the charter approach, in the sense that when you shrink down the class sizes, when you put the kids in schools that are more catered to what they need at that time, it might be easier for them to go through those paces that everyone has to go through as they're growing up, because their education is a little bit more individualized, because we can recognize that each child is an individual and a one size fits all isn't necessarily the best approach. So that's really, really great.
And if I can just make a quick point about class sizes as well, because it is something that's really interesting in the research. So a lot of independent school families do really want small class sizes. That's one of the things that parents do seem to value. But the research really does not show that small class sizes are necessary for student achievement. The research really does show that what matters most is teacher quality and not actually the class size. So in two countries that tend to do really, really well on PISA scores, the Program for International Student Assessment, which is sort of the best international testing standardized test that we have to look at student achievement. And it's part of the under the OECD. So if you look at Singapore and China, two countries that really kind of compete for the top spot on those PISA score rankings, small class sizes are not necessarily a part of their education system. They tend to have larger class sizes. It's definitely larger than in Europe and even Canada. The class sizes, there's really not that same emphasis on small class sizes. And so it's really not necessary to produce strong student achievement. But it might be something that some families might really value and might really want for their kid, right? It depends on the kid. So I found that an interesting point, because it is something that you often hear from kind of like governments and unions as well, that like we need smaller class sizes. It might not be that the reason why classrooms are struggling or not struggling, classrooms are hard for teachers to kind of get a handle of, which I, like you, have so much respect for teachers and the work that they're doing. I have lots of teachers in my family, and it's a challenge. It depends on the kind of, you know, the class that you get. It's a real challenge some years, particularly if you have multiple kids in the class that are struggling with very unique and very different needs, it can be very difficult. And so perhaps, you know, some of the policies that might even help that is having this more tailored, individualized, different types of educational options within the system, that educational diversity, reflecting the fact that our student population is very diverse and has different, yes, interests. They might be interested in performing arts or music or basketball or whatever it might be, but they also might have very different learning needs, whether they're, you know, quite gifted or whether they might have you know, dyslexia or be on the autism spectrum or whatever it might be. There's all sorts of different kids with all sorts of different needs. And it's very difficult for teachers to kind of teach all kids that are at different levels together. That is a challenge that faces our education system. So there's no perfect solution for that. But it might be that the public school system being one size fits all kind of makes that a little more difficult. Whereas, you know, there are countries where the class sizes are quite large, but they're actually producing really, really strong student achievement through their educational systems. So anyway, it's sort of just like an open question. You know, there's so many different things that feed into education policy and, you know, might help us answer these sorts of questions. How to make life easier for teachers, make the whole educational experience smoother and more enriching for teachers and students and parents and families and everybody. But certainly, I just wanted to add that in, that it's not necessarily that classes need to be small for strong student achievement, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't support some schools and families that want small class sizes in their educational models, because it's important to them.
Absolutely. And that's just educational choice, which is what we've been talking about this entire conversation. So here's an interesting question. And I don't know, I live in Ontario, so I can only speak for Ontario because I don't have tabs on the rest of the country. But in Ontario, I know that there's a lot of teachers right now who are stuck in the substitution role because there is an overabundance of teachers and not enough positions to be filled right now. So if one of the biggest indicators of student success is the quality of the teacher or the teaching, as opposed to the class size, could one of the solutions for our education system to improve it potentially be raising the barrier to entry for teachers or requiring more education for teachers so that regardless of class size, we can raise the level of achievement of the student?
So what I would say to that, I know that in Ontario, there's been sort of that policy discussion around teachers need to take like a math course in order to have that kind of proficiency in math before they can enter the teaching profession in Ontario. So yeah, the governments have looked at policies like that. So of course, that is sort of a policy option available to governments. One thing that I would say is really important, and some of the work that we've done at the Fraser Institute is looking at standardized testing in Canada, which is actually on the decline. So we can see that there's two kind of problems, and standardized testing is a test of students. It's a test of how the teacher is doing at getting that material to students. It's a very important test to see how our schools are performing, how individual classrooms and students are performing, and how our education system as a whole is performing. So it's a very important tool in our toolbox that we have. However, our research shows that right across the country, it's actually on the decline. People can go to our website, fraserinstitute.org. We last year did a series of papers on standardized testing. So if you want a more in-depth look into that, you can see it. There's kind of two problems. So one problem is that testing itself over the last 20 years has declined in Canada. It takes place less often and at fewer grade levels. And it also emphasizes less subject-specific knowledge, which is an important part of testing, because basically what you have now is the tests that are coming in are more vague, and what they measure is more vague. So it's less clear of, you know, an outcome for us to then work with if you're a policy maker. The tests are also less meaningful for students, meaning that they don't contribute, they're lower stakes. So they less and less contribute to whether or not a student passes a course, or whether or not a student can graduate, or whether or not a student can then move on to the next grade. That the meaningful, their meaningfulness or the meaning of the tests is actually reducing as well in general in Canada over the last 20 years, which basically is just to say that we have less testing data to work with to actually be able to truly measure how our students, our teachers, our schools, and our provinces' education systems are doing. So this is a really important problem. The other thing that we know from the tests that do exist is that student performance is actually declining. So in Ontario, for example, EQAO results, that's the standardized testing or the province-wide testing program in the province, show that student performance have declined. So just a few numbers that I wrote down. So more than half of grade six students do not meet the provincial standard in math. So 40% of grade six students in Ontario meet the provincial standard in math. Only 59% of grade three students meet that provincial standard, and 52% of grade nine students. In BC in 2019-20, only 40% of students that took the numeracy exam, which would be sort of like math exam, were proficient or above. So only 40% were considered proficient above, or above rather. And just under 3/4 of students who took that exam, so this is in grade 10, were proficient or above in literacy. So just about 75% of students were proficient or above in literacy in grade 10 in BC. And we know that school closures, because of the pandemic policies that governments put in, school closures really exacerbated this problem for a lot of students. I saw it with my own child. You know, you're right at the cusp. He was sort of right at the cusp of that, like, learning to read age. That's a difficult age if you're not going to be a parent who has the time to kind of work at home with your kid to kind of get them over that hump. School closures were a really difficult challenge for a lot of kids that were at that stage in reading, or even at a stage in math where they're just starting or you're struggling to accept or understand a concept. And the changes to the math curriculum also made it a lot harder to help kids at home for many parents. And we know as well from research from the US that it was actually marginalized kids. Research from Stanford and Harvard showed that it was marginalized kids that were hit the hardest by these school closures, that they actually fell back the furthest from this. So all of that is to say that standardized testing, students' performance is declining, and standardized testing is also declining. So we can't even really get a clear picture of where student performance is declining as much as we might have used to. But we also know that standardized testing is really important to parents. So we did a poll last year showing that 95% of Canadian parents of K to 12 kids believe that it's important to know their child's academic performance in the core subjects by a fair and objective measure. So only 1% of parents in Canada that we polled did not find this important at all. We used the polling firm Lege to do this poll. And explicit support for standardized testing in Canada, 84% of Canadian parents of K to 12 kids explicitly supported standardized testing to know how their child is doing in the core subjects of reading, writing, and math. And we found strong support across all provinces. So what I would say is the most important thing in making sure that we have quality right throughout the education system, and if we don't, to know where and why and in what mm-hmm. subjects mm-hmm. and at what levels, we need to have a strong program of standardized testing, which again is opposed by teachers' unions, but is actually very strongly supported, according to our polling, by Canadian parents.
Why opposed by the unions?
Well, some of the arguments that teachers' unions have made is that it's too stressful on kids, too stressful on teachers. Teachers have to teach to the test, so they can't focus on other things in the classroom. There's a whole host of reasons, but ultimately, it is a test on teachers, really, just as much as it's a test on kids and as much as it's a test on governments and curriculum writers and everybody to know how our system is performing. So it's, I guess, politically contentious for that reason.
Sure,
but ultimately, parents and children are going to be, especially children, students, those are the most important stakeholders in education. And where you do see parents who do pay these bills in education, regardless of what kind of school you send your child to, you're paying the bill. They do strongly support this. And so it is a really important test to know how the system is performing.
Yeah, absolutely. I almost can't believe that we didn't get to this yet. And I wasn't really intending on getting to it, but it's a big question mark in our country right now. And you touched on it briefly. What are some of the concerns coming out of all of these school closures and the pandemic, and not just the educational pressure that was put on these children, but the emotional pressure? I mean, for me as a 30-year-old, the pandemic was a stressful experience. I can't imagine having to navigate that with the emotional intelligence of a 7-year-old. What are the concerns for those particular students most heavily affected? And what are some of the proposed solutions that we're tossing around right now to make sure that those kids get what they need to be well equipped for life going forward?
Yeah. So I mean, to get back to standardized testing briefly, I would say that's it's more important than ever. We need to know where our kids are at. After this extended period of school closures, your province and my province, these are the two provinces that close schools the most, yeah. Ontario and Nova Scotia. And so kids were out of school for so much time during the pandemic. And in addition to that, you had a lot of parents who were very afraid and probably kept their kids home, you know, additionally longer, even though there were school closures. If your kid, I went through this, if your kid even had the sniffles, they couldn't go to school. So they were home quite a lot, because if you are like me and you have young kids in school, they get the sniffles all the
time. Kids always have
all
sniffles. Year, so. It's like their part-time job.
Yeah, it's a perma sniffle. So it's, there were those challenges as well. Also challenges with masking. Kids, you know, who were at that. And again, it was sort of there's been like 3 years, but 2 years of really seeing these policies in effect on and off, where there was masking. And in here in Nova Scotia, they kept masks on kids longer than any other province in the country, and certainly longer than most, if not all, certainly most of the world, in schools, even when they had the masks off adults. And that's hard for kids who are learning to speak, to form their sounds, you know, with when they're in that kindergarten or grade primary, as they call it here, age, or junior kindergarten, pre-primary, where they're really learning to form those sounds. Like, so that was a real challenge for kids as well. They're also, you know, for kids who are learning to read, as I mentioned, that's a challenge too. The research shows pretty much that if you aren't comfortable reading around that grade 3 age, that you're going to be facing really significant challenges going forward. You need to kind of have a comfortable handle on it by that age. Otherwise, it's going to be more difficult for you afterwards. And so if you've got kids who are in that grade 1, 2, you know, and they didn't have the ability to get that support from parents at home, whether the parents, you know, didn't speak English, for example, English was not their first language. Yeah. So teaching them to read in English is not going to be their strong suit. Maybe they were some of the parents who did not have the luxury of being part of the laptop class, and they had to go to work at the grocery store, and so they couldn't help their child at home to supplement their education and read. Those kids face a lot of challenges as well. Even just emotional regulation, you know, like for example, kids who were having to wear masks at young ages in school, even just learning, seeing the emotional reactions on their teachers' faces, on their, you know, fellow students' faces, those kinds of things were challenges for young kids as well. Kids face a lot of challenges from school closures and from the policies when they went back to school as well. So I think that it's so important. Of course, I would say that tailoring kids' education to them, to fit them, it's important at all times, but being able to get kids engaged back with their education system, regardless of the reason they go to school. They go to a sports-enriched school because that's something that the government empowers them to do, whether it's by having sort of choice within the government public school system, or by having charter schools, or by having independent school choice to make that more of a reality. Maybe sports is the reason that kid gets up in the morning and goes to school. That's really the most important thing, right? To get them to school and get them engaged in going to school and in that learning. That's going to be so important. But I would say that one of the most important things is certainly the standardized testing aspect. We need to know how far our kids have fallen behind before we can address the problem. Right? We need to know what the problem is. We need to know where each kid is. We need to know where the classrooms are and where the school system is at to really be able to address it. And I think a lot of people are saying, you know, it's fine. They've all kind of struggled together, but that's really not the case, because some students, as you might well know, as somebody who is homeschooled, some students do great at home. And so some students were home with their parents and they actually, I've heard from parents that they actually excelled. They learn, oh my gosh, we're like above a grade level now because working at home with my kid is something that actually worked really well. I know families that then stuck with homeschooling after the pandemic because they loved it, right? So, I mean, it was a completely different experience for a kid whose parents were not there because they had to go to work. And they didn't get that help they need, and they didn't have internet access at home, so they couldn't go on and be a part of their Zoom school versus a kid whose parent was like, actually, this works so great. Let's continue homeschooling or let's continue supplementing education at home. You are now more advanced than the rest of your class, or certainly more advanced than you were because of working from home. Every kid's experience is different. And I think that the COVID policies really exacerbated that. And so having that more tailored educational approach is really important now, but certainly getting back to that testing is important so we can know what the problem is so that we can properly address it.
Yeah. It's too bad that that's resisted because it would just make logical sense to say, hey, we had this crazy thing happen that probably really affected a lot of kids. Why don't we figure out who got affected and how they were affected so that we can begin to build solutions for them? It's too bad that that's opposed by unions. And I don't necessarily know how to go about fixing that, but I'm sure that's part of what you do at the Fraser Institute. And I thank you for that work. We got to wrap up here though, unfortunately. This has been a really lovely chat. For people who want to know more or who want to better understand what their options are, where can parents go to learn more about how they can get their kids involved in the right education for them?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can go to FraserInstitute.org. We have a whole bunch of research on educational choice policies and what they look like in different parts of Canada. We have a whole bunch of policies or research on standardized testing, some of which I brought up on the independent school landscape in Canada. There's a whole bunch of stuff that you can find on our website, FraserInstitute.org. Always feel free to reach out to us and email me with any specific questions. But yeah, ultimately, I mean, we are always happy in helping provide research to the public and to governments to try and kind of advance the understanding of why education that fits every child is important and why it actually might be great for provinces and governments as well.
Awesome. Well, Paige, thanks. Thanks for being here. And I hope we get to have you back sometime soon.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to The Canadian Story. You can find us on Instagram and Twitter at The CAD Story. That's The CAD Story. If you enjoy this podcast, please share it with your friends and family. Let's work together to remind Canadians how great their country is.